Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 221 to 21. And we're now in Exodus chapter 12 and verse 1. Now, last time I just wanted to make correction about a certain point. You know, sometimes when you listen to the tape later on, you discover certain things that you said or didn't say properly. And so that's the time to do it. And basically, when the plague came upon Egypt in terms of the hail that destroyed part of the ground and the crops, I mentioned the flax and the barley, that the flax was destroyed and the barley was not. Actually, both of them were destroyed. And so rich and poor were affected by it. Anyway, let's continue now with chapter 12. And verse 1 again, we'll continue from that point. And here we read, "And the Lord spoke unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, This month shall be unto you the beginning of months." Rosh Chodashim, the word Rosh is basically head of the months, and that's why they say in Hebrew Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year. And it is the head of the year because Nisan is not the head of the year. Nisan is the head of the months. So we have to understand the difference. And that's the reason why in the Jewish calendar they do not use as Nisan as the head of the year, because it is not. It is the head of the months that have to do with the holidays. And so it's not that they know, they do not know the difference. They do know the difference, and that's what they call the head of the year, Rosh Hashanah, and for Nisan, the head of the months. And so they celebrate the head of the year in terms of the creation. As for Passover, that's for religious reasons, so it's a different story there. And so this is what God is saying here. This month is going to be the head of the month. It shall be the first month of the year. And from now on, we're going to begin the calendar in that sense from Nisan. But it is the spiritual calendar in terms of the holidays, but that has nothing to do with the count that was begun from the beginning of time in terms of the creation. So we have to understand the difference, why it is that Rosh Hashanah is not Nisan, because it is not Rosh Hashanah. It is a Rosh Chodashim. And this is the difference between the two. Some people think, you know, the Jews have lost their understanding there. Certainly they did in many areas, but this was not one of them. They have a good reason to continue to call Tishrei the head of the year, because it is. While Nisan is not the head of the year, it is the head of the month in terms of the sacred calendar, in terms of the holidays. So that's in essence what God is saying here, and he hasn't changed. Some people think that God had changed the order of things, and he hasn't, because creation is still creation. It happened at a certain time. You don't go down the road and say, no, it didn't happen at this time, it happened later on. You see? So that remains still the head of the year, while this one is the head of the month. And so this is what he says to him. This is going to be the way from now on. You're going to count now in terms of the sacred calendar. So he says it shall be the first month of the year to you. And what year is it talking about? Not the year from the day that the world was created or recreated, but in terms of the sacred calendar, from now on you're going to regard this month as the head of the year. And he says, "Speak you unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, In the tenth day of this month they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household." Now, why on the tenth day? Why not on the 11th or the 9th? You see? Why not just on the same day that you're going to do it? Obviously, it had to have a special purpose there, and a spiritual one. And when people ask Moses, why the tenth one? And why not, you know, on the last day? Obviously, he gave them the answer. It was not recorded, but you can imagine that people would ask this kind of a question. And then, until the days when Christ appeared on the scene, and the last year, you see, when the Passover occurred, that the disciples began to understand the spiritual connotation of this statement that was there from the beginning. It was directed for the Savior, for the real Lamb of God. And he began his final stage of his offering, so to speak, on the 10th day when he came to Jerusalem. And that's in essence what they were doing here. And so on that day, on the 10th one, they've taken the lamb, and you can imagine, as many others have noticed, those points that the family got attached to it, especially the children. But even though, you know, the head of the household and the wife and everybody else, you know, they're taking care, each family will do that. And mind you, this happened here is the first time. And later on, it was a different story, because later on, they just went to the temple, and there they had the lamb, you see. And there were the special lambs that were being raised for the temple sacrifices, for the Passover. And so when they went over there, that's when they bought the lamb. You know, if they arrived in Jerusalem earlier, they could have done it, you know, buying it the 10th. But if they had not, they would just buy it, you know, whenever they did arrive there, and it could have been the last day. So here it's in essence a sort of a first one. And how many kept, you know, this custom all the way, we don't know. And then we read here, and if the household be too little for a lamb, then shall he and his neighbor next unto his house take one according to the number of the souls, according to every man's eating, you shall make your count for the lamb. And your lamb shall be without blemish. A male of the first year, you shall take it from the sheep or from the goats. And we oftentimes think about Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God. We don't think about Jesus Christ, the goat of God. But he was both. Because that's what the Passover sacrifice was all about. It could have been either a lamb or a goat. Now, generally, it was a lamb. And the people of Judah, later on, as they were keeping the Passover, apart from Israel, who went into captivity, they basically stuck with the lamb. And so that's what you read in history. They had all those flocks and the shepherds, and but, you know, some people may have preferred the goat, so they could still do it according to the law. And both of them, when they were a year old, without spot and without blemish, could represent the ultimate sacrifice that was given for God. You know, when the goat is a bit older, God doesn't want it, but for that matter, he doesn't want the lamb also when it is older than a year old. And so the innocence here is what really counts, and without spot and without blemish. So you can see the whole family is involved in that, and maybe, you know, keeping their eye on it even long before that, and maybe preparing it for that purpose, and then basically setting it aside on the 10th day of the month. So you can see an involvement there on the part of the family, an attachment to this animal, and then when they sacrifice this animal, it becomes something very special to them. And God meant for them all the way to learn this lesson long before he told them what it really meant. And many of the teachings that God gave Israel, they did not know what they meant, just like the day of trumpets. And most Israel to this very day, they still don't know really what it means. What's the purpose of it? And until it happens, they would not know. And so many teachings were given to Israel on that basis. And when those things happened, then they understood. And when the things that Christ spoke about happened, then his disciples understood. Oh, that's what he meant. And that's basically the way God works with us. Not everything that he gives us, he explains to us to begin with. And that's why we live by faith also in those areas where God says that a good understanding have all they that do his commandments. So you first do them. You don't understand why you do it. You may understand partially. Or you may think that you understand. But when those things really come to pass and become a reality, then you really understand. That's when you have the good understanding. And so you have to begin by doing it, and Israel was doing it. And they were doing it to one degree or the other, not that all the nation had done it. They went most of their history into idolatry. But still it was done every single year. Somebody always did it. They were always the faithful. And all this time they were doing it without understanding until it became a reality in the generation of Jesus Christ. Then they really fully comprehended this whole matter, what it really meant. And so he says in verse 6, and you shall keep it until the 14th day of the month, you see, until the 14th day, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at dusk. So they picked it on the 10th day, and they kept it until the 14th day, and when they arrived at the 14th day, you see, you had to arrive at the 14th day to do it. And unfortunately, some people as they read this account, or more correctly, misread this account, they had, you know, the different understanding. And many of us were a part of this understanding for a long time. We did not really fully comprehend properly what the scriptures were telling us, and so we, in essence, invented a doctrine. Let's say our leaders have done that, and they sold us, you know, this understanding, and we just took it on faith. and we followed it, and there are still many to this very day who are still doing it, not having a proper understanding. And so when they count to the days of Jesus Christ, you know, they begin to argue about what day it was, before, after, the day before, you know, the evening before, on the day. Well, that created problems. And yet here it is in Moses. He made it very plain when exactly that sacrifice took place. And as we read the scriptures here in chapter 12, we're going to find out exactly from the mouth of God. Not the mouth of man, not the mouth of Moses, not the mouth of the Jews, but from the very mouth of God. When did these things occur? And that's why I mentioned earlier, and we're going to see it again here. When God told Moses in the burning bush about the departure from Egypt, and then later on he repeated that again. He said that when that time comes, all the Egyptians will just, you know, because of the death of the firstborn and the firstborn of everything that they had, they're so distraught at this point, and they all rush, all the Egyptians around Israel, around Goshen, they all rush to the Israelites and just kick them out. He said, that's what he said, they will chase you out. You see, not just tell you where to go, but they literally will chase you out. And that's why, that's the reason why I told them earlier, as we're going to read it right now, to be totally prepared to be thrown out of Egypt. And they were. And yet people, because of their misunderstanding, you know, and trying to bend the scriptures to their own petty theory, they totally misread this, and in essence forced their own understanding on the scriptures. And they said, oh no, they had a whole day in between, you see, because that happened the night before. That means on the 13th, not on the 14th. And therefore they had a whole day to go and spoil the Egyptians, and God made it very plain. No, you know, you're going to take up the jewelry from all those who are in your neighborhood, and for that you need just a few minutes, and from those who live in your own house. And as it is, they were going to throw you out, literally, you know, throw you out of the land, because they were afraid of what was going to happen to them. And so, let's think about these things as we read the scriptures and see what God has to say, not what man has to say, regardless of who that man is. And so he says, he said, you shall kill it at dusk. That is, you keep it until the 14th and you kill it at dusk. And when that time happens, again, you know, people began to invent understandings here. The word in Hebrew, ben arba'im, and so many articles were written about it, and so many words, and so many phone conversations, and all that. And all that in vain, because a lot of ignorance there on the part of many, unfortunately, because they, in essence, twisted the scriptures to fit their own understanding. And so now they had to give it their own connotation, their own meaning to it. You see, these are the complexities of men, in contrast to the simplicity that is in Christ, who explains exactly what it is. And so when you read it from the point of view of those who kept it all these thousands of years from Egypt, not necessarily the whole nation, but at least there were those who still kept it, but from Egypt to this very day, who maintained that understanding and never lost it for 3,500 years, you see, they had a better understanding of that, and we totally rejected that understanding. But as I explain it here in the commentary, at dusk, what does it mean? Why? We read better towards even, toward the evening, you see. Because we're talking about Hebrew idioms, and if you want to understand Hebrew idioms, you don't go to foreigners, you see. You go to natives that speak the language and understand the idioms, not only at this time, but in the old days. And so he writes here, better towards even, literally between the two evenings, ben ha'arbaim. Now, in Hebrew, as I explained earlier, the im signifies plural, but the ayim signifies double. In other words, you have two eyes, and so you say enaim. You have two legs, and you say raglaim. You don't say raglim or enim. That's plural, you see. You use the double concept of it. You don't have that in English, but you have it in Hebrew. And so for double, you use the ayim. And so when it says arbaim, it means between two evenings. So there has to be two evenings there. Well, what does it mean, two evenings? Every day has only one evening. So how do you come up with two evenings? Well, again, you have to go to the culture, to the idioms of the language, to the people that know. You see, sometimes we have to humble ourselves and go learn from the babes, so to speak, and not be arrogant and think we know better. And that, unfortunately, was the reason why that understanding came about. There was arrogance there on the part of those who came up with it, not humility. not going to the babes who are in strength, especially the ones that really did know it and were not confused as we were. And so you see the explanation here, and according to the Talmud, which basically recorded what was understanding from the days of Egypt. It was not the, you know, the concept of the rabbis, it's just, you know, they just recorded reality. According to the Talmud, the first evening is the time in the afternoon when the heat of the sun begins to decrease, about 3 o'clock. Now, generally speaking, when the sun begins to go down, that is from noon, up to noon it goes up. At noontime it begins to go down, so technically, God made it very plain. Technically, you can begin to prepare the sacrifice as soon as 12 o'clock is over, because he made it later on clear, at the going down of the sun. You see, now by 3 o'clock, it's certainly, you know, certainly it's on its way down. And so, but in the, you know, in the culture of the time, and to this very day, they still understand it the same way. And when you think about it, even in the United States, they understand it this way. When they say good evening, you leave work and you go home, it could be 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, or even 2 o'clock, you say good evening. And so it's not far-fetched when you think about it, but certainly there they understood that and they understood the mechanics of it too. And so the first evening is the time in the afternoon when the heat of the sun begins to decrease, about 3 o'clock. And the second evening commences with sunset. So Josephus relates that the Passover sacrifice was offered from the 9th to the 11th hour. You see? And the 9th is 3 o'clock. And the 11th hour, obviously, it's 5 o'clock. So it was between 3 and 5. And so when you talk about the morning sacrifices, they were in the morning. And when you talk about the evening sacrifices, you see, it was when it's still light. So the priests can see what they are doing, and the people can see what they are doing, and that was the evening prayer, and it still is to this very day. The evening prayer in the synagogue has to be during this period of time. And if it is after time, it is no longer called the evening prayer. You see, now it becomes the night prayer. And that's when they have it, between 3 and 5. Well, they have the evening prayer, because that was the time of the sacrifice, and that's the reason why they have that evening prayer, for the time of the sacrifice, and the morning prayer during the time of the morning sacrifice, around 9 o'clock. So there were about, 6 hours in between the evening and the morning sacrifices. And so, as we mentioned earlier from the beginning, we just alluded to that without going through it, in Hebrew, you see, the word erev, what does it mean? It's not the same as in English. You just say evening. But, that doesn't explain it, because, what does evening mean? The word itself. You see? Now, when the sun is up, it is up. When the sun goes up in Hebrew is the sun, zorachat, means shining. You see? And so, from that word comes east. East, west, south, north. Why is it called east? Because east means to shine. That's what east means in Hebrew. The words have meanings in Hebrew. They don't have it in other languages in the same way as they do in Hebrew. And that's the original language that is being spoken here, and the language that God is using and conveying his thoughts, his emotions, his feelings to Israel in truth. And if you don't go to that, you don't understand what you're reading. You see? You're missing an awful lot. And so, east means to shine, because the sun shines. And when the sun shines, you see, it shines from the east. But then it goes down toward the west. So what does west mean? West means ma'arav. Why is it ma'arav? Because when the sun goes down, gradually it goes down toward the evening. You see? And when it goes toward the evening, it goes west. And so west and evening are the same, from the same root, ma'arav. And that's from that word, basically, all those people, they're called Arabs. That's the reason why they're called Arabs. Because they used to be in the Babylonian territory between the rivers, and everybody that went west was called an Arab. So was Abraham called an Arab. So all the Israelites were called Arabs. What it means is, those are the people that went west. So in modern language, they were called Westerners. You see? In other words, when we think today about all the, the West, America, Europe, and Northwestern Europe and all that, in biblical terminology, they're all Arabs. What it means, Westerners. You see? But what does west mean? When the sun goes down in that direction, you see, when it goes down, you see, toward the evening, so the evening becomes known as Erev, West means Ma'arav, you see, and the two are linked. And from that you have the people that are called Arabs. And so let's understand that. And so when the sun goes down, you know, technically the evening begins. And so at 3 o'clock it really is already in full swing. And so when he says between the two evenings, he's using Middle Eastern terminology, Hebrew terminology, you see, because even the Arabic uses the same terminology of Erev, you know, a little bit different, but still the same, you see. And then they understand it. Well, now, when people that come from Western society that know nothing about even the word, you know, West, what does it mean? And they begin to read the Bible with no knowledge, no understanding, no context, no background, and they think that they're smarter than everybody, you know, everybody who lived before them, and certainly they think they're smarter than the Jews. You see, they've been around all this time and kept this information, and it's still in the language, and oh, every Arab can tell you exactly the same. Every Semitic language will tell you exactly the same. They are more or less, one way or the other, use the same terminology. The languages were very close, all the Semitic languages. Well, you see what you end up with. You see? That's why, you know, the proverb says, you know, before the fall comes pride. And it was pride that produced this ignorance that people thought was wisdom. And they're, you know, having endless debates about it. You know, as Paul would say, you know, and then others, they don't know, you know, what they're talking about. And we should not be this kind of people. And so, this is what we see here. That's what between Harbai means, between 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock, which are two evenings. Then also you have the sun. You see, when the sun was up in heaven, it looks the smallest. When it rises, it looks the biggest. When it goes down, it looks bigger again. You see? And so, again, when the sun is up, it's called little Shemesh, little sun. And when it goes down, it's called big sun. And so there was also another terminology, you see, between the suns. In other words, between little sun, big sun. And little sun was noon, and big sun was evening, because it went west. So a western sun is Erev, evening, and when it is up there, it is a little sun. So, you know, you have these terminologies between the two, but, you know, in specific, between Arbaim, already made it very plain. A Jew never had a problem, an Israelite never had a problem, a Semite never had a problem understanding it, a Middle Eastern person never had a problem with understanding it, be it the Assyrians or the Egyptians or anybody else, where the languages were closer. They all understood exactly what Ben Harbaim means. Modern men, unfortunately, departing so far away from that, does not. And so with ignorance and blindness and confusion, people begin to read the Bible, and what do they end up with? As the Bible says, when the blind leads the blind, they all fall into the ditch. And you can imagine all the belly laughs, you know, that the angels were having, you know, listening to all this, and to this very day, all this constant, endless debates about Ben Arbaim. What does it mean? And long papers that were being written about it, and books, and this and that. And all ignorance, you know, just bubblers, you know, from the point of view of God. And that's foolish. You know, we shouldn't fall into this kind of foolishness. And so we're going to continue and see again what God is talking about. What does this period of time really mean? Ben Arbaim. And when was the Passover? And when was the Passover, the original one? And we're not talking about the Lord's Supper that he had to take, obviously, before he was dead. You know, when you cannot take the Passover when you're dead. But it was the time when he was dead that the real Passover was being eaten. And that was the correct time. But obviously the Lord's Supper had to happen the night before. Nobody eats when he's on the cross. And so we read here and we continue. Ben Arbaim. And verse 7. And they shall take all the blood and put it on the two side posts and the lintel, which was a one-time affair. They've never done it after that because, you know, they had to go to the tabernacle or the temple for that. And they didn't do it in the wilderness either for 40 years. They couldn't do it for 40 years. Why? Because they lived in tents. You see, you don't have this side post that you have on a door. You don't have doors to a tent. You just have an opening. So that was a one-time affair they've done in Egypt where they had homes. And then when they came to the land of Israel, they had to go to the tabernacle, which they were doing for 40 years, and then later on the temple. And so that custom of doing this was one-time affair that was done in Egypt, basically. And so he says, they shall take all the blood and put it on the two side posts and on the lintel and upon the houses wherein they shall eat it, and that time was for a specific reason, because the death angel was passing that night. Now the death angel doesn't pass every single night of the Passover for the rest of the years of the children of Israel. It was a one-time affair. That's why, that's the reason for this one-time affair of the blood on the doorposts. And they shall eat, it says, and the, verse 8, and they shall eat the flesh in that night. See, it was at night, after they, you know, they obviously offered it, sacrificed it, cooked it, you know, all this whole period of time that took to do it, and it takes several hours. You know, you don't have the modern equipment, it takes several hours to do it, especially a big one, you know, for the whole family. It's not a tiny little one. And, you know, when you kill it between 3 and 5, we certainly are going to have it ready by mealtime. And mealtime is not midnight. Mealtime, you know, it's regular time, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and or 8 o'clock, or 9, you know, the latest, because of that late sacrifice. And so they shall eat it, eat the flesh in that night, roast with fire and unleavened bread. Notice that, unleavened bread, with bitter herbs, they shall eat it. And so he tells them, eat it not of it raw, nor sudden, you cannot cook it at all with water, but roast with fire, its head with its legs and with the inwards thereof. Because all that was later on to be understood of the ultimate sacrifice that was totally hanged on the cross. Whole body, you see. A whole sacrifice, not a partial one. And certainly he was not cooked. And obviously he was not roasted either. But that was a trial, that was a spiritual concept there, the trial by fire. That was his ultimate trial by fire that he went through. So that was symbolic for the real lamb. But it was real for the lamb, the physical one that you ate, obviously, because otherwise you cannot eat it. And you shall let nothing of it. So even the lamb, you know, the physical one, where, you know, had his own final, ultimate trial by fire. And you shall let nothing of it remain until the morning, but that which remains of it until the morning you shall burn with fire. And thus shall you eat it. Now this is the manner, with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staff in your hand. You see, that tells you that as soon as they say, God said, as soon as the Egyptians hear and know, you know, about the firstborn, they're all going to rush toward you and throw you out, literally. They're not going to hang around for another day. They're not going to put up with you being around for another day. You see, that's not chasing. That's not throwing somebody out of your house. You don't say, oh, well, stick around for another day, and then at the end of the day, you know, take off whenever you feel like it. No, well, when calamity comes, you know, they just literally rushed over there and threw them out. You know, maybe some with anger, and some with trepidation, some with fear, you know, all kind of mixed emotions that were there. But they literally, as he said, will throw you out, chase you out. Literally, they ran after them. Get out of here, you know. And just like they would say in the South, get, you know, just get out of here. And so that's exactly what it is. So God told them, you be totally prepared. And so they were. And you shall eat it in haste. Also eat it fast, you know. As soon as you had it cooked, start eating and eat it fast. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will go through the land of Egypt in that night and will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both men and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. Because every, you see, the gods of Egypt is speaking about in specific here are the animals that they worshipped, and for which reason they regarded all the shepherds as an abomination. And sacrifices was an abomination to them, you know, sacrificing their gods. And so he was going to kill every firstborn of every animal they had, you know, be it a horse or a mule or a dog or a lamb or a goat or an ox, anything, every firstborn. That's what God is saying here, is going to execute judgments on the gods of Egypt. And including the man himself, Pharaoh, who was regarded also as the god. You know, he too, that is his son, was going to pay the penalty. And any firstborn in any Egyptian family, the head of the house, you know, the firstborn, whatever it may be, that too was going to go. And so he says, I will do all those things. I am the Lord. You see, they are not. I am the Lord, and you two Israelites better remember that. So it says in verse 13, and the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. So it is God himself who did it? So when you read later on the angel of the Lord, people get mixed up and think, oh, God didn't do it, it was an angel that he sent, the death angel. No, God himself, he is also, as you read in many other places, the angel of the Lord. That's one of his offices. You see? At that time he's revealing that he's being sent by another one. And we went through that thoroughly earlier, so we don't need to repeat it here. And so he says, I will pass over. He didn't say, I'm going to send an angel. He said, I will pass over. I will see the blood. You see? I'm going to destroy. And so he says, I will pass over you, and there shall no plague be upon you to destroy you. When I smite the land of Egypt, I'm going to do it personally. You see? And then he personally gave himself as the firstborn of many brethren to be killed. He personally gave himself, you see. And he did it willingly, on his own accord. And he ascended to the cross. Not grudgingly, not screaming and kicking and yelling. And so you see the similarity there too. As he smote the firstborn, so he was going to allow himself to be smitten as a sin for all mankind. And so verse 14, and this day shall be unto you for a memorial, and a zikaron in Hebrew, and there's an interesting concept behind it. Well, what does memorial in English mean? It's just a word. In Hebrew, zikaron. What does zikaron mean? To remember, you see. But what does it mean? You know, the word remember. How do you remember? You see, when you engrave something on a piece of wood, on a rock, you see, that process is done how? You take something, you know, a stick or, you know, with sharp edge or an iron or whatever it may be, you see, and you basically engrave, that is engrave, you know, applying pressure on it, and from that, then we begin to understand the concept. The biological concept, the male is called Zachar. You see, why is the male called Zachar? And the female is called Nekeva. Why is she called Nekeva? You know, in English you just say male and female. Well, what does that mean? What does male mean? What does female mean? Well, in Hebrew you have meanings for it. And God is not using words, you know, without meaning. Everything has a meaning. And people that don't understand, you know, the original language, what God is speaking about, they lose an awful lot in the process, unfortunately. And Zachar means, you see, as again, you know, I said, you know, in order to engrave, in order to remember, you see, either, you know, you remember it in terms of putting, in engraving it, you know, you take something and you engrave it on your mind, you see, and you're doing it by, you know, symbolically speaking, you take that ink horn or, you know, the chisel, whatever it may be, and you engrave on a rock or engrave on your brain, and so the male was called Zachar. Why? Because a male has what God gave him, you see, the ability to engrave with his own sexual organ, the penis, you see, to engrave, so to speak, by using this pressure, you know, we're talking about sexual connotation here, by the insertion of the penis into the, you know, the female part, you know, the vagina, and then he's sort of engraving in the sense of his spitting, the, you know, the sperm, and a newborn comes. And that becomes a remembrance for this man, for future generations. You know, this is a biological thing, obviously, but you can see the connotations there. And so he was called for that reason Zachar, you see. And for the Nekeva, she was called Nekeva because Nekeva, what does it mean? It means a hole. Nekev, linkov, to make a hole, you see. And so you take something like that and you make a hole with it. And if you continue the hole, then you're writing something. You see, like in the old days, that's the way they wrote. Let's say you can write on the sand. You know, you stick your finger there, and you can, you know, you see the analogy there of the male penis, and you apply pressure, and you write on the sand. Now, if you want to do it on the rock, obviously you cannot do it with your finger. You have to take something to replace your finger that is harder, would not break, and you do it that way. And so, in essence, that's what he says in terms of the memorial. You see, you understand, you study the language, you have the context in the background, you begin to illuminate your mind, you know, sevenfold, and you understand much more the Word of God. And it's not as boring as it is when you don't understand what you're reading. And so when he says a memorial, that's what it is. You know, you take something and you literally engrave it on your mind so you remember it forever. You see? Because when you write on a rock and when you write on your brain, it remains there for eternity. And scientists tell us today that anything that the brain has ever you know, that the mind, you know, together with the brain has ever recorded, remains there for eternity. You can never erase it, like when you put it on the hard drive of a computer. And in one sense, that's sort of scary, but when you think about it, that's exactly what God was talking about. By every word, you know, that you shall be judged. And so when we are brought before God, our hard drive, you know, is going to be exposed there, and everything that we ever had done, thought, failed, is recorded there, and God is going to expose it, so to speak. He's going to put it on the screen, and He's going to look at every single thing there. You see, that's the kind of a mind God gave us, and that's the reason why man was able to, later on, duplicate it and create this hard drive that he puts in the computer. That's exactly what it does. It records everything. A lot of people were trying to get rid of information, then they forgot that the hard drive recorded everything, and somebody smart enough knows how to dig it out. And so people are afraid to put on the computer something they know they have no business doing if they don't want anybody else to ever find it. So that's what the memorial is all about. Well, you know, you see, from one single word, look what you end up with. And that's what he's saying here. And you shall keep it a feast to the eternal. So it's not for a short time. When you create a memorial, that's for, you know, as long as God wants it there until He Himself blots it out, and He has to blot it out before it became, you know, it ceases to be a memorial. And so He said, you shall do it throughout your generations, you shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. You see, I was talking about the feast, not talking about the blood that you put on the doorpost, but the feast. And then He says, 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. Now He's talking, first He's talking about the Passover, which you eat on the 14th day at even. You see, on the 14th day at even, that's when they kill the Passover. Now He's going to talk about the days of unleavened bread. And we want to know, when do the days of unleavened bread begin? Do they begin the day after you eat the Passover? You know, like some of us in our ignorance are doing or have done. Now let's see what God Himself has to say, not what man has to say. And so He says, 7 days shall you eat unleavened bread. Howbeit, the first day you shall put away leaven out of your houses. In other words, on the first day that you begin the leaven, it should already be gone. It's not that it is there for on the first day, but it says when that first day comes, you get rid of it. And whosoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, and from the first day obviously includes the first day. You see? That soul shall be cut off from Israel. A lot of people today don't care much about it, and they don't realize why there are curses upon Israel. You see, well, there are curses upon Judah. Because a lot of Jews, nowadays, in past generations, they were all meticulous about it, but nowadays, most Jews are not even religious. And they've got a lot of problems also. Not that they didn't have in the past, you know, they had other problems then too. And all of Israel is also paying the penalty for it without even knowing it. Even with all the blessings that God gives us, still there are a lot of penalties with it. A lot of sorrows and pain and affliction and sickness and disease and death and war and bloodshed and hatred and animosity and broken families and homes and all that. You see, these are all curses, not blessings. And God says, that soul shall be cut off. Either immediately, if God chooses to, in war, or on a gradual basis, you know, being wasted through a sickness or disease or poverty, whatever it may be, or depression. And so He says, and in the first day there shall be to you a holy convocation. So the first day of unleavened bread is a holy day, and in the seventh day a holy convocation, you know. And it's not something that you say, well, you know, I don't like going there, I'm going to do it at home. Well, you cannot have a convocation at home unless you bring other brethren with you, then you have a convocation. You know, that's a different story. And so you have to go to a place. If you don't have people in your home coming for the convocation, you have to go someplace, and you cannot do it on your own. Otherwise, you are disobeying the law. And a lot of people do it thinking, you know, I don't need anybody, I can do it on my own. Just open the Bible and read it, and that's it. Well, God does not accept that worship, no matter how sincere it may be on our part. See, we don't play games with the laws of God. And so I said, no manner of work shall be done in them, save that which every man must eat. So on that holy day, you can, you know, prepare food. On the Sabbath, you don't. You do it on the day of preparation, which is Friday, the day before that. But on a holiday, you can cook. And I remember growing up, you know, coming back from the synagogue, and the ladies would always be in the kitchen, and their attitude, you know, toward the kitchen is different than the Western world today, the attitude of many. And they rejoiced in being in the kitchen, and they certainly wouldn't let anybody in. That was their domain, their kingdom. And they were preparing all those wonderful things for the feast, a lot of them, on the holiday. And, well, you know, those are beautiful memories for them and for the men of the house. And that's what they were doing, so they could do it on the holiday. in verse 17, and you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for in this selfsame day, you see, he's talking about the days of unleavened bread, and then he's saying, he's not talking about the Passover, he's saying, you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for in this selfsame day. And what day is he talking about when it comes to the unleavened bread, the 7-day period? He says, in the selfsame day have I brought your hosts out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, you shall observe this day, and in specific, that day, throughout your generations by an ordinance forever. And now he's going to explain when. Verse 18, in the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at even, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 1 and 20th day of the month at even. Now, verse 18 basically explains to you very plainly when the Passover was killed. As you backtrack here, and you read that you take the, you know, the in earlier verses, in verse 3, in the 10th day, you take the Passover, you know, there is a lamb, you see, and you keep it there. And then in verse 6, we read that you keep it until the 14th day of the month, the whole assembly of the congregation shall kill it at dusk. So they keep it until the 14th, you see, and on the 14th, not the evening before, but on the 14th, they kill it. And verse 18 tells you that also that's the time, the very time when the Passover 7-day unleavened bread begins. The same occasion. That's why the Passover, as we read earlier, must be eaten with unleavened bread. You see, they didn't have unleavened bread the day before that. They didn't make it. They're supposed to make it, you see, from the, on those 7 days. And so in verse 18, it makes it very plain. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at even. And so later on, you would read in several accounts about the Passover. When do you keep the Passover? In the 10th month. That is, in the first month. On the 14th day of the month, at even. And you can read all the scriptures about the Passover from this point, all the way through the prophets, the days of Ezekiel or Ezra and Nehemiah and all that, and it was always the same terminology. On the 14th day of the month, at even, that's when they ate the Passover, and on the 14th day of the month, at even, that's when the 7 days of unleavened bread begin. So we don't have two holidays there, as man in his ignorance has invented, not considering the scriptures, not looking to Moses. You know, you don't like to go to the Jews because of whatever problem you have. Go to Moses. As God says, remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I gave him. And people say, no, we don't want to remember that. We're going to go to the New Testament. Invent our own Passover and our own timing for it. You see, well, that's foolishness and arrogance on the part of people, unfortunately. And all those days that they kept on the wrong day, God simply did not appreciate or consider. Okay, insincerity is one thing, but on the other hand, you know, you cannot say, well, I'm sincere and I'm keeping Sabbath on Friday, or I'm keeping Sabbath on Sunday, or I'm keeping Sabbath on Wednesday. See what I mean? Our sincerity is neither here nor there to God when it comes to that. Now, he's patient with us when we don't understand, but also his Spirit leads us to truth. And it's not going to lead us to truth if we're stubborn and proud and haughty and arrogant and we think we know better. Nobody's going to tell us otherwise. You see, well, that becomes a totally altogether another problem. And we're kidding ourselves at that point, thinking that we're obedient to God and God is pleased with us and our services, whatever it may be, on the wrong day. Well, anyway, we're going to stop here. And this is again Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.